Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday morning, May 5th. Happy Cinco de Mayo. We've got a soggy day in store. Right now, 40 degrees here in Old Town Park City, 45 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, we have meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's Cinco de Mayo. We're looking at a chance of a few scattered showers and rumbles of thunder throughout the day. We're not looking at a washout. We're not looking at a lot of heavy rainfall, but we will have some nuisance showers moving in and out of the area. So keep that in mind as we progress throughout the rest of today. Temperatures will be a little cooler thanks to the clouds and the showers. So high temperatures only in the upper 50s for us in Park City today. We'll see those high temperatures only in the low 60s in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Wednesday, we're going to get on the backside of an area of low pressure that's going to produce a pretty big winter storm to our east. So if you've got plans to head east towards Colorado, that does include the Denver metro area. They're looking at a significant snowstorm moving off towards the east. But for us, no worries like that. We'll start off with temperatures around freezing early on your Wednesday morning. High temperatures should rebound, but only in the mid-50s in Park City. We'll see those highs in the low 60s. In the Heber Valley, again, we should see more and more sunshine as we progress throughout the day with just a high cloud or two. As we move into your Thursday, look for a mixture of sun and clouds across the area. We'll see those highs rebounding with high pressure building in now. That's going to lead to temperatures taking a big jump. High temperatures on your Thursday will go from the mid-50s on Wednesday to the mid to upper 60s in Park City on your Thursday. We'll see those highs going from the low 60s in the Heber Valley on Wednesday to highs into the low 70s by the time we get towards your Thursday. And the warming trend continues, highs around 70 for us as we get into your Friday with lots of sunshine in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures climbing into the mid-70s in the Heber Valley, again, with plenty of sunshine. Once we move into the upcoming weekend, I've got partly sunny skies for your Mother's Day weekend. Overall, looking pretty nice. There will be a very small chance of an isolated shower on Saturday afternoon into Saturday night. Do not cancel your outdoor plans. It does not like anything significant, just a chance. Highs will stay in the 60s in Park City for the weekend, with highs in the low 70s in the Heber Valley. We warm it up even more heading into next week. That's the latest on your forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, a new study shows for every dollar invested, Park City and Summit County's child care scholarship program generated about $4.25. KPCW's Christine Weller has more.
Since its launch in 2024, the Park City and Summit County needs-based child care scholarship program has grown by 30% year over year. In 2025, 162 families and 186 children received scholarships. The two governments created the program to help local families struggling with increased tuition and long wait lists. So far, Park City and Summit County have contributed $1.56 million to make childcare more affordable. Jessica Chang is the executive director of Upwards, a national childcare network that manages the scholarship program. She said childcare is the linchpin of a functioning economy.
For Park City and Summit County, 43% of our families work in hospitality. A housekeeper earning $40,000 a year faces $1,700 a month for infant care. That's half her salary. It's unsustainable. So either she quits or leaves the region, but the scholarship lets her stay.
The program provides financial assistance to families earning at or below 100% of area median income. Park City families averaged $823 in scholarships per child per month in year two, while Summit County families averaged almost $900. Park City Community Foundation's Early Childhood Alliance absorbs all administrative costs, so 100% of public funds support families and providers. According to survey data from Upwards, the program is helping the community in three ways: workforce retention, increased productivity, and avoided turnover costs. Of the 48 survey respondents, representing 30% of program participants, 83% said they stayed employed because they could afford childcare. Around 40% of families said they reduced work absences, 29% increased hours, 25% improved job stability, and 8% earned promotions. Others were able to pursue education, self-employment, and seasonal work thanks to program support. That translates to about $2.6 million in sustained wages, Chang said, based on the average salary of parents in the program. Chang said the scholarship program also helped child care providers avoid almost $4 million in turnover costs.
100% of providers in the program report being very satisfied with payment timelines and support. In an industry that's used to late payments and bureaucratic headaches, that's huge.
Those numbers add up to around a $6.6 million impact, or about $4.25 for every $1 invested in the program. Chang said since the survey sample did not represent all scholarship recipients, the economic impact is likely larger. Chang said an unexpected positive outcome of the program has been child development gains.
We expected families to say, hey, their kids were in better care. What surprised us was how immediate and specific the improvements were. Parents reported kids gaining speech, motor skills, social confidence within months of consistent quality enrollment.
The program has received national recognition. The National League of Cities selected Park City as one of 16 municipalities nationwide for its prenatal to 3 impact lab. It's a 9-month educational cohort meant to teach cities how to improve outcomes for families. PBS Utah also featured the initiative in June 2025. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
On the phone with an update from the Summit County Planning Department, I have Community Development Director Peter Barnes. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Leslie. Hope you're all well today.
Yeah, doing great. Thank you. So any new applications that have come through the door in the last month or so?
A couple came through in the last week. Nothing to get too excited about just today, but they're large enough to be of interest to the community at large, I suppose. A conditional use permit service area number 3 is looking to install a new large water tank to supplement their facilities over there, over in Silver Creek. That's fairly straightforward, but there are, you know, significant engineering concerns that we tend to look at publicly. They rarely get opposition. Everyone needs access to drinking water, so whatever we can do to facilitate that, we'll get right on it. The other one, just as a matter of interest, hopefully people don't get too excited immediately. We do have the Dakota Pacific Group, also known as Six Ridge Partners, since they changed their name, have come in with their first subdivision application for their property over there. And that's just to divide some of the parcels up so they can come in with their development plans, which will actually be of more interest at that stage. Currently, it's just the administrative exercise of creating the parcels on which to put the project. So those are two, which if people are interested in follow, they will be in Planning Commission in due course.
Yeah, just curious, given that once that division happens of the parcels, is Six Ridge then free to sell them off?
They could. I don't believe that's their intent. We do actually have a sketch plan proposal on one of the parcels, which yet to be subdivided. We do actually have a review application on a sketch plan for their first phase affordable housing project. The terms of the development agreement, they are allowed to sell certain properties off, but it does create parcels that enable individual projects to take place. So I think this first phase, I think there are taking an existing 2 lots and turning them into, I think it's 4 or 5, and then there'll probably be subsequent subdivisions after that.
But any sold parcel would have to meet what was approved by county council?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. They're a very strict development agreement process
okay.
in place.
What's the latest with Klein Dolly? It sounds like both Mountainlands Community Housing Trust and Habitat for Humanity are partnering with Columbus Pacific here.
That's the intent. We're still in this odd backwards and forwards negotiating stage about, you know, the actual unit type, unit mix. It's mostly finances at the moment, which thrills me no end. You know, I'd rather be talking about the design. From a staff level perspective, we have been working on the code text amendment to discuss how the rezone application would be handled, what level of information would be required. That's going to be a change from the current process that we have that requires the construction level drawings to be created in advance of a rezone. Everyone's recognized that that's an onerous process and an obstacle to actually getting what we want done. So we're changing that text, and then the design will follow pretty rapidly after that. But the other interests, you know, the Park City Fire Department, Basin Rec, mountain lands and Habitat for Humanity are all involved. So it gets pretty complicated how we divide up responsibilities and obligations. That's part of the negotiation we're in at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, the area does need a new zone. Where are you with that on developing?
We're working on the language. Staff are actually Amanda Curtis, one of our staff members, put a draft proposal together. We've circulated that amongst the various interested groups at the moment. Once we've polished that language up, our intention is to bring that has to go for a recommendation and approval from the Planning Commission before it goes to Council. Council then have to finalise that before the actual application for a rezone, if any, goes forward. Remember, when we change the code text, this is not unique to this property. This will be a change to the code that will apply for everyone who's looking to do a rezone. So we just have to be a little bit careful to make sure we have the appropriate guardrails in place so we don't get a flood of unforeseen consequences coming through the door.
Yeah. Any idea where else this zone could be used?
Currently, it's going to be an overlay zone. So what we're talking about at the moment, where we had what we call the neighborhood mixed use zone, the NMU zone, there were actually those areas that were designated on our future land use maps in the Snideville Basin as mixed use areas. It was restricted to that. And currently that's where we think that we would be appropriately locating this potential overlay zone. You know, it's not, if you're at the top of a mountain on a mountain remote lot, it doesn't mean you can come in and apply for this zone. And if you did, your obstacles are going to be pretty high. But we're trying to be fairly careful about where we allow it to be used, and tie it actually in with our general plan, our future land use maps that we have in place today.
All right. Now, the 910 Recreation Plan, one of seven plans, coming to the County Council for discussion and a possible vote on May 20th. How is the Planning Department involved on these 8,600 acres?
The Planning Department in a rather odd position here. You know, if people seek our advice, we're more than happy to give it. Jess Kirby in Open Space is essentially responsible for all the public outreach that's been done so far. We have had general inquiries because if an application comes forward, I know there's been talk of a parking lot, for example, a park and ride, a trail parking area, that would require a conditional use permit. So as the reviewers of that application, we don't necessarily want to be involved in giving, pre-advice or pre-approval, design it this way and we will approve it. That's not what we can do. We have to remain very objective. So the general policy plans, what's going to happen over at 910, that's very much a high-level policy discussion at Council. Then the individual projects, if any, that are approved will eventually come through to us. But our involvement as a Planning Department has been very high-level.
Okay. Can you give us any updates on that proposed subdivision on Old Ranch Road, kind of beneath Quarry Mountain? Is that going to be coming to Planning Commission anytime soon?
I would love to say yes, that's coming to Planning Commission sometime soon. There's been a back and forth between the developer owner and Planning Department as managing it. Part of the request is, I think it's no secret, it's an additional density in excess of the base density, mm-hmm. but that comes with requirements for dedicated open space. So there's been a significant back and forth on what that conservation easement looks like and the language in that. So while Jennifer Strait in our office is handling the administration of the planner, those negotiations are being held like legal department, open space. Jess Kirby again at the open space department is responsible for creating the easement and the ownership group. So we'd love to bring it forward sooner rather than later, but I have no news in that regard. As soon as I do, those public notices will go out.
Okay. And then tell me, how is it that the planning staff can negotiate? Isn't that the county council job?
It's not really a negotiation. We have if I use that word, I'm going to apologize now.
It's actually what the wording of the agreement needs to say to make sure it actually meets the code. Once that, the easement, obviously the conservation easement, will be between the owner and the county council or a third party conservation holder. So planning staff do not create this language. We have templates for such a thing, but it's very much a legal debate about, you know, what words go in the language. And then once that's been created and agreed, it then goes in front of the Planning Commission and then Council.
And
they get the final review on it. It's not something that planning staff negotiate. We just said, this is what the code says. Show me how you're meeting the code.
All right. You did not use the word negotiate. You used back and forth. So I just was kind of curious, though, how much that was involved.
It's a language problem, Leslie. Yeah. It's always happened between us.
All right. The Eastside Planning Commission has a work session this week on the Lost Creek Zone in Browns Canyon on Thursday. What's happening here?
The Lost Creek Zone, if you remember, that this was a process that was instigated by Ivory Homes on behalf of a group of landowners on Golf Ranch in Browns Canyon. Their intent is to apply for a new zone. And that new zone will come, you know, like, not dissimilar to the process that went through at Cedar Crest, a little bit different. They're laying it out differently. But before they can actually come in with a development proposal, we actually need to create the zone itself so that they can apply for the zone. So a few weeks ago, they were in with a draft version of that proposed zone, which was reviewed by the Planning Commission. They received comment and input from the Planning Commission about certain direction and things that they wanted to see. So this is the next meeting on that, a further discussion. We have had interest and inquiries from members of the public. There are some members of the public out there who are unsure whether they can attend a work session. The answer is yes, you can. Obviously, you can. These are open meetings. You are very welcome to attend, whether in person or on Zoom. Listen to the conversation. It's not a public hearing at this stage, but when it gets through the work session process, there will be public hearings before this conversation moves up to council. Having said that, the day before on Wednesday, the Eastside Planning Commission will be having a joint meeting with council to discuss some of the broader based policy issues that have attracted the attention of the Eastside Planning Commission over the last year or 18 months. And we're hoping that we're going to get some kind of guidance and advice on policy from the county council tomorrow evening.
Yeah, what are some of those agenda items? I mean, what are you looking at specifically?
Well, obviously, we're into the general plan discussions right now, and the Planning Commission have been excellent in offering comments and advice on the draft general plan, which will be coming forward this summer for public hearings and then moving up. But as part of that, the questions always arise. You know, in the East Side, we always talk about what we know as small town rural values. It's almost a little like, you know, the apocryphal story of pornography. You know, what is it? I don't know, but you can tell when you see it. So what are small town rural values? How do we write those into our general plan? But beyond that, the specifics, water is a big issue. Open space is a big issue for everybody, obviously. You know, it means different things to different people. Affordable and attainable housing been a big subject on the East Side for a long time now. We know that prices on the East Side are not as high as they are in the basin, but they're going that way. So what can we do in order to incentivize affordable housing and attainable housing without losing that small town rural character that we want to maintain? So having that conversation with the county council with regard to policy issues, so we don't spend a significant amount of time going in opposite directions, that's going to be a very useful discussion tomorrow.
Okay. Back to the Lost Creek Zone. Is that currently zoned 1 per 40?
I'm going to say yes, but it might actually be 1 per 80. It's AG 80 currently. So that's really one unit for every 80 acres. But the conversation, I believe we were, if the new zone that is created then becomes an application for a plan, that plan was proposing I think it was over 3,000 units in that location, which would be nowhere near what they'd be allowed to have today.
Yeah. Is all property in Summit County, you know, within municipalities and unincorporated, does it have some sort of zone?
Yes. All the property, well, I was going to say everything if outside the municipal jurisdictions, the only properties that would not have a currently existing zoning would be, say, property that's under the jurisdiction of Utah Department of Transportation. So, like, you know, Highway 248 is not zoned in Summit County. It's not under our jurisdiction. But outside the municipality, it all falls under our purview.
Okay. And the reason I ask is just with all of the debate happening in Box Elder County, apparently all of the unincorporated land in Box Elder County isn't zoned. So it's a free-for-all.
It's like the city of Houston has no zoning. I'll turn this conversation on its head a bit for a reason. You know, as you remember, Leslie, you were in that first cohort of our planning lab, and zoning is one of the subjects we talk about and teach. It's a tool of planning. Some people don't use it at all, and there are various types of zoning. And the reason why I mentioned planning lab, because before we run out of time, I did want to mention last night our most recent cohort did their final presentations. Excellent they were, too. And special thanks on our part to planning staff members Elizabeth Williams and Mustafa Osman, who ran the class this time around. But really excellent ideas coming out of this cohort. Very good class, very engaged, and some good ideas. So I don't believe we have a large data center in our future. But if we do, we actually have a well-armed group of, you know, well-educated members of the public ready to take that battle on.
Okay. Is there any way to see their excellent ideas?
We'll see what we can do. But, you know, obviously, we have some that were done in that, you know, science fair format, you know, like hard copy. But there were others that were videos and flyers, and some of the ideas, you know, like information sheets to be handed out at planning commission meetings or council meetings. So it's a lot of good stuff. We're going to assemble it all and see how we can share it with the public. But definitely that's our intent. From our perspective in the planning department, we think it's well worth the investment in time and energy. It brings future potential planning commissioners, future leaders to the table, and an educated group of people who we may or may not agree with on the issues, but they know how to be effective in meetings, and that's what we want from the general public.
Okay, Peter, I'm going to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Leslie. Bye now.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and in the studio with details on what's planned and the state of mental health in Summit County, I have Summit County Behavioral Health Director Aaron Newman, joined on the phone by Mental Wellness Alliance Director Anna Fratchow. Good morning to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Morning. Our pleasure.
Good morning, Leslie.
From your perspective, Aaron, what does Mental Health Awareness Month mean for Summit County?
For Summit County, when I go back and look, this celebration began back in 2016 by a group of individuals. If you remember, we had Ed and Lynn Rutan, Ray Freer, and a whole lot of other people that then ended up creating Connect Summit County. It was really just to get awareness about the topic of mental wellness out into our community, to begin the discussion and to start addressing stigma. And so that really is where the foundation of this month came from for our community.
Okay. And I guess in terms of the biggest mental health challenges that you're seeing today in 2026, what are those?
I think right now in our community, it's anxiety more than anything else, especially since January. Last year, within our entire public and nonprofit system, we saw over 7,000 unique clients here in Summit County. So those are people we're seeing free or reduced cost services. Already now, looking at our projections, we're losing and down about 1,200 people coming in, and that's just since January. In conversations with a lot of our nonprofit leaders, there's just a fear right now for a lot of our community, especially our Spanish-speaking community, to come in and receive any form of help right now. So when you talk to the different nonprofits, it's pretty easy right now to get right in because they do have that shortfall.
And that's what I was going to ask. Are there specific populations that are struggling more than others? And it sounds like our Spanish-speaking folks.
Absolutely. There is a fear. Now, where we've seen some increases when services have moved to telehealth, for different partners. They have been able to see and maintain some of those clients that they've been working with before. But generally, the other part of the anxiety we're seeing is a lot of those people that utilize our funded and our nonprofit services are having to move away. They can't afford to remain here in our community, or they're doing a large commute. They still work here, but they don't have time with their commuting.
Yeah. And Anna, can you talk a little bit about some of the trends you're seeing in demand for mental health services?
Yeah, I think when it comes to some of the trends, we continue to see stigma, right? Stigma continues to be an issue that pops up. We recently had a community health, a mental health survey that went out into our community, and stigma was just another point that was being highlighted. And then awareness. We still have an opportunity to increase awareness around mental health services, get more people in our community talking about it, and then really reaching out and seeking those services as well. What the survey did highlight as well, some of the top three issues as to why individuals were having a mental health issue. Some of that was due to affordability and being able to live in the county, which Aaron referenced. The other one was family stress. And then the third top was really due to the national climate and just the political environment we currently live in.
Okay. One of the biggest issues nationwide is access. So are we still, sounds like we still are having barriers in residents are facing in getting the help they need?
Well, what we've seen in the data from that assessment is actually we've made quite a bit of improvements. Mm-hmm. If we go back to when we started all this process back in 2016-17, the average wait time was up to 90 days for someone to get in for a basic treatment. And if you needed more advanced medication assistance, we were up to 120 days. Since that time, most of those services have been reduced to within 7 days for basic clinical care, and depending on the needs, usually within a week to 2 weeks for medication management, just depending on if this is the first intake and assessment or this is just a maintenance appointment.
Okay, and is this still the work that's being done through the University of Utah?
Correct.
As the provider for Summit County?
Yeah, so in terms of the direct public services that we receive funding from both the federal and the state governments, we've contracted as the quote-unquote local authority with the Huntsman Mental Health Institute to provide those services primarily here in Summit County. Now, what makes us a bit more viable for our community is we've created an overall network. So if someone contacts my office, we can work with them to either get them enrolled through Huntsman Mental Health, where we can cover the cost through those federal funding and state funding for an individual who's up to about 375% of what they call the federal poverty level. So for an individual, we're looking at about $54,000 a year that they're making. They can receive those fundings. Or a family of four, we're looking at about $108,000, where they can also receive those services free of charge thanks to those public funds.
Oh, okay. And how would people go about getting the help they need?
The biggest way is simply just to reach out to the Huntsman Mental Health Institute if they would like. But then also, feel free to reach out to all the nonprofits. When we talk about that, we have Jewish Family Services, we have Holy Cross Ministries, we have the Christian Center, and we really work collaboratively as much as we can. Sometimes there's services that they just can't provide at the nonprofits where Huntsman's able to. An example is when we look at really the bulk of services being provided at Huntsman, it's for individuals with substance use concerns. In fact, when we looked at the numbers, we had over 6,000 services for people dealing with addiction and only about 650 for people dealing with a mental health concern. But when we look at the nonprofits, it's just the reverse. We see more of the mental health services being provided through our nonprofits and less as the substance use.
Okay. And so is Huntsman the one that's offering the telehealth so that people don't need to make a trip to Salt Lake City?
Pretty much everyone offers telehealth for the most part anymore. It really came about and found its own steps during the COVID pandemic. And we still see a willingness, especially for people in a more rural area, to maintain that.
All right. Anna, can you talk about some of the programs or initiatives currently underway through the county and the Mental Wellness Alliance?
Yeah, the Mental Wellness Alliance has been working collectively. We've really focused on identifying what are the gaps that we continue to have in our system. And right now we're in the process of collaborating on ideating and solving for those gaps. So more to come there, but very excited movement, great facility, you know, great coordination and collaboration from all of our community partners. During Mental Health Awareness Month last year, we hosted a series of events. This year, we're able to spread those events out over the course of April and May. And so coming up tomorrow night, we are hosting an event at the Christian Center with the Christian Center, and they're helping us put this on. And it's really going to be focused towards parents who have teenagers This event is in English and Spanish. Interpretation services will be available. So really looking forward to that one. On over the weekend, we have Live Like Sam and other community partners are hosting their kindness event, which is a great family event out in Woodward. Highly encourage families to attend that one. And then next week on the 13th at the library, we're hosting an event focused on the loneliness epidemic.
All right. Where can people get the specific dates, times, and places for those events?
Yeah, if you go to the Mental Wellness Alliance webpage, it's on Summit County Health Department's website. There is a calendar of events where we'll have all of the times and locations. We also have some suicide prevention training spread out throughout the month. So individuals who want to be trained in suicide prevention are also invited to just attend those.
Yeah. Can you talk to me a little bit about the Mental Wellness Alliance? Is this the offshoot of Connect Summit County?
No, the Alliance existed since 2016, right? So there was a couple of students here locally, for those who've resided in our community, since then passed away. And that really galvanized our community to come together and focus on coordinating our mental health services. Since then, the Alliance has sat under various leadership and in different locations, including the Community Foundation. Since 2023, there was somewhat of a pause on the Alliance. And then more recently, last year, we have reactivated the Alliance. I stepped into this role. And so now we have the Alliance up and running again in partnership with the Community Foundation. And I'm definitely working at the Health Department.
Oh, okay. So it's really a partnership between Summit County Health and Park City Community Foundation?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. Talk to me a little bit about the role our partnerships with law enforcement or first responders kind of play in all of this.
So in terms of our services, a role of, you heard me use the term local authority. Mm-hmm. That's an official state term. There's 13 of these, but our role in that, playing that role is to basically provide all these state mandated services. So in Utah code, it talks about we have to have inpatient care, transitional housing, we have to do basic outpatient treatment, but then there's an entire section about justice involved. So through Huntsman Mental Health, we oversee not only the services that are provided in the jail, but we do assessments for the courts. Individuals on probation were able to maintain their services. We just entered into a new contract with the Utah Department of Corrections to where now those individuals that are seen by the Adult Parole and Probation, APNP, they also receive free care through state funding to help provide those services. And in addition, we really do work closely with our law enforcement here. One of the things we provide through my office is something called CIT, Crisis Intervention Teams Training. And we're very lucky in that both of our leaders here for law enforcement really believe in having the majority of their officers trained in this. It's a de-escalation and recognition treatment. It's 40 hours of training where they end with scenarios that they get to work on. So not only does it help an officer identify, is this person in a mental health crisis, is this person in a withdrawal crisis, but also how to engage with that person, how to hand them off. And for individuals in a mental health crisis, that handoff generally refers to our mobile crisis outreach team, our MCOT team, which has been very valuable for our community. Last year alone, we saw over 500 direct interactions with our MCOT team in the public. And when the MCOT team's involved, we see a rate of 71% of individuals are able to remain in place where they're at through stabilization by the team. If they're unable to be stabilized, then we have the option to move them down into Salt Lake into inpatient care at Huntsman Mental Health or another facility. We also have access to recovery centers that are down there and receiving centers in Salt Lake. But we don't really see that much of a need to take individuals there because of the success of the program.
Yeah. When you talk about addiction, I mean, what are we looking at? I mean, is it drug, alcohol? I mean, do you have some kind of percentages of what you're dealing with?
Based on what we see as the primary treatment causes, really it's alcohol. Alcohol in our community accounts for 84% of the addiction services that we're seeing provided. After that, we start looking at stimulants, and that's a catch-all term, but that's generally where we start to see cocaine, meth, those different services as well. And when we look at sort of the Summit County Recovery Drug Court Program, which is a partnership with multiple agencies, Third District Court, the County Attorney's Office, the Sheriff's Office, and my office, we really see that that also matches up in terms of what are the primary diagnoses for individuals. And we see alcohol rising to the top.
Okay. Let's turn to youth. Mental health, of course, continues to be a major concern, as Anna noted. You know, this alliance starting back in 2016 when we had a couple of Park City teens die as a result of using narcotics. What are you seeing among young people in the county?
Again, we still see the same issues that we're seeing facing adults. Anxiety is very high for most of the youth we're seeing in our school-based services. And so for people that aren't aware, it falls to the county as the local authority to provide all the clinical services within a school district. So we have a contract with UTEC at the University of Utah, I can never remember what UTEC stands for. But in short, they provide clinicians and psychiatrists for our schools. So we're able to have trained clinicians in all of our schools with the help of and support of three psychiatrists, each one assigned to each school district. So if there is a need for medication management, we're able to help provide that resource.
Yeah. And when you talk about youth anxiety, I mean, what are they anxious about? Have we seen any improvement in that? The fact that we are like locking up phones during the school day?
Well, I'm married to a teacher, and in her sense, she is seeing a big benefit with that. But when we step back from it, we're still seeing a lot of the same anxieties. And there's a sense that really social media, the research is showing social media still remains a concern point. The other aspect that we're seeing too is just this, I believe someone was just talking about this, people using AI, especially our youth, that they're having this sense of loneliness and they're now finding ways to have these relationships. Although they're completely fake online and they're based off algorithms, they're using that to replace the one-on-one interactions between people. And that's actually very dangerous. Several years ago, there was this case that's still pending right now of a child who took their life because they were using AI to deal with suicidal thoughts. And as they went through it, having these conversations, looking for ways to help them, because the algorithm pulled from the internet, it eventually said, you know what, no one likes you. And it started leading that child down that pathway to where they unfortunately eventually took their life.
Okay, and Anna, any advice for parents who may be worried about their child's mental health?
Yeah, there are a lot of, I think having teenagers these days, it's just very difficult, right? This generation has lived through a lot, and that also is causing their anxiety as far as how they've come up across the last two decades. So I think accessing the resources, really, we have, like I said, the event tomorrow night focused on parents. There's Trailhead Parent Support, which is another newer nonprofit starting in our community simply for this purpose. Out in Colville, we have Live for Luke, again, another parent support group. So we're having these parent support groups coming up. Live Like Sam is an excellent resource as well. And I just encourage, there's a lot of evidence-based information, education, and programming out there. Definitely access it. It doesn't hurt to just inquire.
Okay. Anything else either of you would like to add?
I think the only thing I would add, just in reference to parents and anyone in the community, is there's an app called Safe UT. So it's Safe and then just UNT. It's initially designed for schools, but it's a great tool for everyone to have on their phone. So if you're working with someone and you think there's a concern with their mental health, a suicidality, you can just hand them your phone and they can have a private conversation, text conversation, directly with the State Crisis Center down in Salt Lake. And in that, once they give you the phone back, the conversation is completely deleted. No one could ever see it. So it's something I really encourage everyone in the community to have on their phone.
Okay, Aaron Newman, Anna Fratchell, thanks so much for your time this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
The Summit County Attorney's Office has launched a criminal inquiry into the Wasatch County Sheriff at the same time he was being investigated by a state standards board. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has more on that.
Utah Peace Officer Standards and Training, or POST, the state council that polices the police, opened an investigation into Wasatch County Sheriff Jared Rigby late last year. It told KPCW April 29th it closed that inquiry with no disciplinary action against Rigby. Rigby, who is seeking a third term as sheriff, said in a statement he believes the complaint to Post was politically motivated. He said, quote, "When I decided to run for re-election, I was warned that my opponents would try to destroy my life, have me criminally investigated, and subject me to civil actions." KPCW has reported on four investigations into Rigby and his office since March 2025. Two investigations were conducted in 2025, One was a criminal probe by the Cache County Sheriff's Office, the other a civil investigation by retired 3rd District Judge Richard McKelvey. Another inquiry is ongoing. The Summit County Attorney's Office is investigating Rigby for felony obstruction of justice for allegedly interfering in the recent Corey Richens murder trial. Retired Wasatch County Lieutenant Shane Fredrickson says Post was looking into whether Rigby had been dishonest during McKelvey's initial investigation. Fredrickson participated in that investigation after bringing concerns about the Sheriff's Office to the Wasatch County Council. He said he was also interviewed as part of Post's process.
The purpose of the investigation was whether or not he was truthful under Garrity, was what I was told.
Garrity warnings caution that law enforcement officers can be disciplined for refusing to answer questions or hiding the truth during an internal investigation. McKelvey wrote in his report about allegations the sheriff had passed test answers to his preferred candidates for promotion. McKelvey said Rigby flatly denied passing on test questions or answers to candidates. McKelvey confirmed to KPCW that he provided his witness recordings to Post in response to a public records request. Rigby said the Post investigation was one in a string of false allegations meant to keep him from being reelected. The Republican will face off against Summit County Detective Eric Maynard and another member of the GOP, Jeremy Hales, in the primary election June 23rd. No Democrats are seeking the sheriff's post. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
While ICE detained a Park City High School graduate last month, sending him to a county jail in Wyoming. What happens next and what are his options? KPCW's Connor Thomas spoke with an immigration attorney to learn the legal process.
When federal immigration agents detained Lisandro Pantaleon Pacheco on his way to work April 29th, his girlfriend tracked him first to West Valley City, Utah. Then Immigration and Customs Enforcement transferred the Park City High School graduate to a county jail in Evanston, Wyoming. Immigration attorney Kendall Moriarty with Teeter Legal says that's a common situation. ICE's main enforcement and removal operations office in Utah is in West Valley. ICE checks in detainees at EROs and then transfers them to temporary holding facilities. Moriarty says ICE contracts with county jails in Wyoming, among other places.
Where there's bed space, so they can hold people there for several days at a time until a place opens up in Vegas or Aurora or Tacoma or, you know, Adelanto, Santa Ana, you know, one of these other larger detention facilities.
From there, she says some people can be deported in as few as 2 days if they're willing to go back to their home country. Others request what's called relief from removal, which prolongs the process. Pacheco's attorney, Adam Craik, has indicated that's what he'll do. But Moriarty says options are often limited because by design, quote, the law is written very narrowly.
Someone like this, who is a contributing member of the community, has no significant criminal issues, you know, has significant ties. By all accounts, you know, is an American culturally, right, has lived here their whole lives, mostly their whole lives. It's possible that he doesn't, you know, have a lot of options for fighting it.
One of the first options is a habeas corpus petition, which challenges whether Pacheco's detention is legal. If successful, a federal court could order immigration agents to release him, often on bail. Attorneys say habeas writs have been easier to obtain since the Trump administration has expanded detentions and deportations. But detainees still must go through their removal procedures after they're released. That happens in immigration court, which is part of the executive branch under the Department of Justice, not the judiciary. That's where Moriarty says the odds are often stacked against people like Pacheco, who doesn't have legal status since he was brought to the U.S. as a one-year-old.
Then you can appeal within the DOJ to the Board of Immigration Appeals, and that's what we call the BIA.
The appeal board's decision is final and can mean someone is immediately deported. Moriarty says in rare circumstances, someone facing removal can appeal that decision in federal court back into the judicial branch. Federal judges may pause the deportation, but they don't have to.
In which case, you can be deported while your appeal pends. And then if your case is overturned or changed on appeal, they would be required to bring you back.
The Department of Homeland Security has not responded to KPCW's request for comment on ICE's actions in Park City April 29th. DHS told Fox 13 that Pacheco admitted to being in the U.S. illegally and that he'll remain in custody pending immigration proceedings. Pacheco is not known to have a criminal record other than a single traffic violation. Craik has said he's aware of ICE detaining 7 or 8 people in and around Park City on April 29th. He says another detainee was a Deer Valley employee, also with no known criminal record beyond traffic violations. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
It's the first Tuesday of the month, and that means that the Utah Bar Association provides free consultations with attorneys here at the Park City Library. It is a first-come, first-served offering. It'll happen tonight, 6 o'clock p.m. Arrive early to sign up. For more information, you can visit parkcitylibrary.org. Well, with the while the need for affordable housing continues to grow, securing housing tax credits has become increasingly difficult. Plans to redevelop the Holiday Village and Parkside apartments are being redesigned in an effort to move forward. Mountainlands Community Housing Trust has long been focused on building new affordable units. Executive Director Jason Glidden says that's becoming harder as construction costs rise. He says policy changes may help offset some of those costs.
Zoning can be a very easy way for local governments and even the state to drop some of those costs. So I'll continue to push on that and try to find ways that I'm not looking to increase the density 10 stories or anything like that. But I think there are some opportunities for us to increase density, to reduce things like lot size that have made it really tough for us to get the density that we really need to see.
The HOPA project involves 2 apartment complexes off of Kearns Boulevard, Holiday Village, and Parkside Apartments. The original plan was to rebuild the existing 122 units and add nearly 200 more, constructed in phases to avoid displacing current residents. Parking was going to go underground, and approved plans included a 20% parking reduction to make room for the new construction. Glidden says Mountainlands recently failed to secure the low-income tax credits required to move ahead, the fourth time HOPA has been passed over. Now he says a less ambitious project is being considered.
And it really came down to costs, specifically looking at the underground parking costs that are extremely expensive, especially when you're trying to hit the rent levels that we're trying to hit. Right now, we're in the process of a redesign, and we put out a request for proposal to have a firm assist us in that. But we'll be making a decision on who we're going to be working with, and this is just for the pre-construction side of things. So just the design of the project and then understanding how we're going to put the capital stack together for that.
The next tax credit application is in June, but Glidden says the redesign plans won't be ready in time. He hopes to reapply in January. Depending on the scope of the changes, the project could require another round of Planning Commission review, potentially adding 6 to 8 months to the timeline. Meanwhile, Mountainlands is exploring alternative financing options beyond tax credits. The organization continues to offer its self-help program, which has built more than 450 units so far. Mountainlands is also partnering with Habitat for Humanity and Columbus Pacific on additional affordable housing at the Klein Dolly property in Jeremy Ranch.
There isn't a current zone that would allow for what we were trying to do. And so I know the county's working right now to try to create an overlay zone, an affordable overlay zone, that would not only for this project, but moving forward for other projects, creating these smaller lots, which are really key for us, smaller homes that we can then sell at an affordable rate.
More information on these projects is available online at kpcw.org. Basin Recreation wants to hear from residents about the recreation experiences and amenities that matter most. The organization is planning to expand its year-round recreation spaces, but before it moves, it wants to hear from locals. There are 3 open houses, the first happening today until 12:30 p.m. at the Field House on May 7th from 12:30 to 9 p.m. at the Field House, and then tomorrow from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Trailside Park Room. Residents can also fill out the Finding New Ways to Play survey online at basinrecreation.org.